Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Özil marca. Mesut Özil, el envío al área, el remate, y ahí está el primer tanto del partido. No lo celebra, por supuesto, Aaron Ramsey. 0-1 para el Arsenal.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, goodly evening to you, even though it's goodly morning for me.
Yeah, I guess. It's 4 o'clock here, and 8 o'clock, is it, there?
Yeah, just gone 8 o'clock in the morning, so it's this weird time zone thing that I find it very hard to get my head around, to be honest. It's strange and weird, and you feel quite removed and distant from things that are going on in the part of the world that you normally exist in, but it is what it is. Yeah, so it's, yeah, this is LA time.
And how is your time in LA? How is it treating you?
Really good. It's been warm, not too hot. I've been in the sea quite a bit. First thing in the morning, get up, leave the hotel, and just go down to the sea and throw yourself in, and it kind of washes away all the foggy headedness that might have been achieved the night before.
Lovely.
We had a great event yesterday. Myself and Elliot from the Arsenal Vision podcast and James Bange from Football London. We were down in a bar called the Underground in Hermosa Beach. Just so many Arsenal fans there coming out to just mix and mingle and have a good time. And yeah, it was amazing. So it's been so far so good. We've had some great food here as well. We've got to say a shout out to Joaquin, who's at Morning Pint on Twitter, who's an LA man and who knows his way around this city. And he has helped us in a big way find really good places to eat. Man, we had some Korean barbecue on Saturday night and it was just...
I saw pictures of that. It did look amazing. That's really cool. And is it today? Is today game day? It's so confusing, the time difference. But you've got a game today, right?
Well, no, there's a game in Denver today. They're playing the Colorado Rapids in Denver today, which I believe is going to be a fairly young team because I think the Rapids have got a game of their own on Wednesday, so I'm not 100% sure on what sort of a fixture it's going to be tonight in Denver. But then the game in LA is on Wednesday, so there's Tuesday, there's like a training session and a press conference, and then on Wednesday, of course, the game itself against Bayern Munich, and there's a press conference and all that kind of stuff afterwards. So that'll be very interesting because we'll get to hear directly from Unai Emery about, I guess, some of the things that have been going on or not going on, as the case might be. So it'll be the first chance for people to get up close and personal with him and ask him about, you know, the situation this summer, the transfer business and all the rest. So I'm very interested to see how all that goes down.
Yes, and it will be our first glimpse of Unai Emery's new teeth gnashing. So that will be good to see too.
Up close and personal with his choppers, yeah.
Yeah. I was just working out where Denver is. So it's about 2.5 hour flight from LA. So I guess they'll just be hopping over there for the game and hopping back. So do you not think that all the players are going to travel to that one then? Do you think it's going to be like a bit of a mixed team that they send there? Or?
I think so. I mean, maybe they will all travel and just keep the team together and do some team bonding. But just from speaking to somebody, they suggested it would be quite a young team. So maybe more of the fringe players or the younger players who are back a bit early and have a bit more training under their belts. Because, you know, we're playing Monday night, then you're going to play Wednesday night, then you're going to play Saturday, then you're going to play, is it the following Tuesday, I think, against Real Madrid? So I guess they have to be mindful of the schedule, so we'll see. I think this game against the Colorado Rapids feels a bit kind of squeezed in to the schedule.
Right.
I don't know if that was at Stan's orders, because, perhaps, well, if you're going to be in America, you better come and play my very successful MLS team. It feels like it might be a bit like that, or maybe just, you know, let's get over there and have a chat with Stan himself, who obviously this morning will be feeling under huge pressure, you know, to turn things around. But look, we'll see what it is with this game. I don't know what time it kicks off. It kicks off around 8 o'clock tonight, local Denver time, which is late at night for you guys over there. I'm not sure it's going to be on ESPN or anything here, so I'm not sure if I can keep up with it, to be honest. But yeah, I think what happens in the next couple of days will be quite informative, though. You know, when things get a bit more formal in terms of the game against Bayern Munich and what have you.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think what you've missed, really, what you've been away. I mean, obviously, we've seized control of the football club. I assume that news has reached you.
The reaction to that statement has been amazing. This morning, you know, to have woken up, because I think it went out just as I was going to bed here, maybe a couple of hours before, you know, last thing at night it was going out. So that again is what really confuses you about time zones. But you know, the reaction to it, I think, has been really interesting. I know you and I we discussed this a bit, and we'll probably discuss it. I guess we'll have a question or two about it in the second part of the show. And I think we discussed, you know, the statement itself and what its purpose was and what it was going to potentially achieve. But it's been quite interesting for me that the focus of the reporting of the statement has been really, really focused on Stan Kroenke and KSE and the way they're running the club.
Yeah, I think that is sort of the line that a lot of the major media are taking around it, and I think justifiably so. And to be honest, I think that's kind of what I would want them to take out of it. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, any statement that's got as many signatories as that one does inevitably ends up being quite broad, because there has to be sort of consensus and there has to be collaboration.
Exactly,
In how it's worded and what you arrive at. But I think that despite that, you know, I think there is a clear focus on the owner. And one of the things that I sort of quite like about it is it's not yet completely combative. It's not necessarily a case of, you know, trying to kick somebody out of the football club quite yet. It's asking for more engagement. And I think that, you know, I'd love to believe that message would have some sort of reverberations on that side of the pond. I'm not enormously optimistic, but it's been really encouraging to see the degree to which Arsenal fans have embraced it. And it's been very nice to see, you know, Arsenal fans who've spent so much time disagreeing on stuff in the last few years rallying behind something. So that feels promising, and that feels positive, and that feels like the start of something, really, which I think is definitely a good step.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the I think the fact that so many people have come together to sort of put their name to this statement inevitably, as you say, means it's quite broad. But, you know, if there is one thing, I guess, that we can all agree on, well, I can't say that we would all agree in it, because there are going to be some people who don't like the statement or who don't agree with the sentiment of the statement, and that's absolutely fine. But for me, it certainly feels that, you know, we all have our issues with, you know, the players, or we all have our issues or beliefs or opinions of the manager and that kind of thing. But if there's one thing that I guess a large swathe of the Arsenal fan base do come together on, it's the fact that Kroenke and KSE, since they've taken over and since they've been running the football club, there have been things done poorly that need to be done better. And if it makes them sit up and take any kind of notice, then it can only be a good thing. So, you know, like you, I'm not sure that Stan is going to sit there this morning in his office in, whether he's in Denver, or I guess he would be in Denver because the team's going there, but, you know, between here and there, because they're building this huge stadium in LA at the moment, so I'm sure he's spending his time. I don't think he's going to be sitting there quaking in his boots by any means, or paying perhaps any attention to it whatsoever. But it's the first time, isn't it, that something like this has has gone out as representative of the people involved in signing the statement. You know, it's not saying that all Arsenal fans feel this way. It is just a number of people who have concerns over the direction of the football club, the way it's being run, and the need to change certain things in order to get us back to a place where, let's remember this, KSE and Stan Kroenke have very specifically said they want us to be. They want us to be winning trophies. They want us to win the biggest trophies, the Champions League, the Premier League, on a regular basis. That is what they said. So it's really about holding them to account over the statements that they have made, you know, the very few statements they've made when speaking publicly about their ambition for Arsenal. And we can see, I think, all of us, that what they say and what they're doing are very separate things, that you can't operate the way they're operating and hope to achieve those very lofty ambitions, which is winning the biggest trophies in the game.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, when this statement was being discussed and you and I spoke privately about it going out, I had some reservations over the timing. But I think, you know, while we were sort of waiting for the window to close, but I think the timing of it coming out while Arsenal's top level executives are with the Kroenkes in America, you know, that could be beneficial. You know, it might be that if there is any discussion of it, or even if it's just low down on their agenda, that the fact that everyone's in the same place and able to actually talk and communicate might prove beneficial in some way. I also think that, I know it's the transfer window at the moment, but I don't think I would have been happy to put my name to something that was just sort of demanding signings. You know, I feel like Arsenal fans maybe have slightly sort of cheapened their complaints. You know, been a bit boy who cries wolf with, you know, demanding more money, demanding more signings. I think that what this letter shows is that it's about more than that. You know, there's discussion of the atmosphere, there's discussion of the prospect of the European Super League. You know, I think it's more focused on sort of the direction of the club and where we're going and how it makes us feel, you know, because I think that is ultimately more important than a shiny new signing and probably almost what you win, really.
Of course. And, you know, as much as we're frustrated by the lack of signings, you can't say that the club haven't spent money in recent years. They have spent money. They spent a lot of money on two strikers. They spent a lot of money on players in the summer of 2016, for example. You know, we didn't spend the money well. So it's about improving the way that we spend the money that we have. You know, it's not just about, you know, get us a striker, get us a central midfielder, get us a central defender. All of those things obviously are very important. And I hope that between now and the end of the transfer window, we address those issues within the squad. But, you know, this is not about just signing some fucking players. It is really about more than that. And I think the direction and the way that we feel about the club is the key point here for me, because we were at this event yesterday with people from all over America came here. There were people from California, obviously, but from all over California, which is a very big place. There have been people who had driven up from Dallas and from Houston. There were fans from all over the world in that pub yesterday. There were ex-Londoners in the pub who are living out here in LA, and it's amazing because we all have this connection to the football club, and that's what brings us together. But if we can't see what the direction is and what the purpose of the football club appears to be right now, it becomes quite disenfranchising. And I think, you know, you make a good point about the fact that Raul and Vinay and everyone basically is out there right now with the ability to say to the Kroenkes, look, this is the way that people are feeling. This is the way that they feel about their club. And we've got to do something about this, because ultimately, unless they do, the effects on ticket sales, the effects on the marketability of the club, the brand Arsenal, as much as we don't like to think of Arsenal as a brand, you know, all of those things become even more problematic. You know, you've got to go through another Europa League group stage where, you know, regardless of what we might do on the pitch, there are going to be stories every game, because there's going to be, you know, thousands of empty seats because people just aren't invested in the Europa League. And these are the realities of the situation at the club right now. And the only people who can really do anything about it are the people running the club, and ultimately the people who own the club, who put those people in place as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in the last few seasons, for different reasons, there's been a lot of focus on other individuals within the football club. And I think justifiably, you know, I don't think it was wrong to hold Arsene Wenger to account over what happened on the field. I don't think it was wrong to hold Ivan Gazidis to account over what happened off the field a lot of the time. But ultimately, the buck does stop with one man, and that is the one man who owns this football club. And I think, you know, his name being in the headlines, being in the national media, being discussed as someone who is accountable for what is happening at Arsenal is a positive thing. And, yeah, and shifting the discourse, shifting the direction, you know, and turning the gaze on him is good, because, you know, if anything is going to cause him to act, it might be that. And, you know, I have to couch this all with, you know, I'm not enormously optimistic, because, you know, Stan Kroenke is not beloved by the fans of any of his American franchises, and, you know, has come under significant criticism from them in the past, and it doesn't seem to have prompted much response from him. But we know how dynamic and powerful Arsenal fans can be, particularly in the online community. So it will be interesting to see how much this grows and if there is any kind of fallout from it.
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, it's got people talking about an issue that most of us, whether privately or publicly, would have some concerns about. Mm-hmm. You know, if you talk to an Arsenal fan, you talk to them about, you know, the way the club is going, do they have any real faith in the owner? They don't. They don't. So, you know, why not talk about it? Let's get it out there. Let's start a discussion. Where it goes from here remains to be seen. I feel like the club are going to have to address this in some way, because as far as I can see, and I've just woken up, and again, it's quite weird to try and keep on top of things from over here just because of the time zone. You feel really, well, everybody, it's almost like living in the past in a strange way, because by the time I've woken up, stuff has been going out all day in the UK. But I've kind of lost my train of thought here. just talking about the reaction to it. Yeah, I think the club are going to have to make some kind of response to this, because it's in every newspaper, as far as I can see. It's in the Times, it's in the Guardian. I saw it was in the Mail. I'm sure it's in all the tabloids. You know, yeah, it can't spread that far and that wide without something from the football club as a response to it. I don't quite know when they will do it. I don't quite know how they will do it. But you can't imagine that this morning in the US, Raul and Vinay and Josh and Edu, you know, aren't talking about this, because it would be ignoring a fire in the corner of the room, basically.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's been a sensation on social media, I think, in the last 24 hours. Basically, only Love Island seems to have been tweeted about more. And this is in the fallout of an incredible sporting weekend, too. I mean, you probably wouldn't have caught any of it over there, but the Wimbledon final and the Cricket World Cup final were like gripping stuff. I'm not a cricket fan, but I was glued to the television, couldn't take my eyes away from it. And so sort of the fact that this issue appears to have sort of piggybacked that and taken over the agenda this morning is encouraging. And like I say, just from a sort of emotional perspective on it, it is just nice to see people setting aside differences, setting aside infighting, and rallying around a cause that does unite Arsenal fans. I think it, you know, that's quite a sort of nebulous thing, but it's nice to see Arsenal fans feel together and united. I'm sure you sort of experienced a bit of that yesterday at that event in LA, but to see that happening sort of on a global scale online is also really good.
It is. Look, it's an issue. It's a problem, and now it's been addressed very publicly, and we'll see what impact it might have. I'm not quite sure how much it will, but I think it's important that at least it's been put out there now, rather than it being a a thing that festers in the background, or, you know, in back channels, and without something just very public. I'm curious to see how it'll go. So maybe we'll have a question or two about this in the second part of the show. What else has happened? Obviously, the Lauren Koscielny thing dropped just before I left. I'm curious to find your take on this. What's your thoughts on the way Koscielny has behaved and the way that this situation has played out over the last two or three days?
I think it must be a consequence of what happens when you have key personnel in important roles within the club moving on. You know, it feels like a situation where the fact that we've had a change in manager, we've also had a change in chief executive, probably feels like quite a big contribution to why Koscielny feels quite unhappy. And, you know, while maybe certain promises were made that weren't kept, or maybe he just feels things might have been different under the previous regime, because it is very out of character from him, have to say. There's been no indication of this at any point. You know, he's actually a player with the calibre to have left Arsenal in his peak and gone and played somewhere else, but there was never any noise about that. He was always happy to sign an extension and stay at the club. It's a real shame, I think, and I think it does slightly tarnish, of course, everything that's come before, and I think it feels like a situation with no way back. I expect it to end with Laurent Koscielny leaving the club, and that's a problem for us because he's still our best defender.
That really is the key thing, you know, as poorly as he's behaved, and there's absolutely no condoning the way he behaved and the way he informed the club that he wouldn't travel on the tour. As a captain, you have a responsibility. As a senior player, you have a responsibility. But simply as a professional footballer being paid by Arsenal Football Club, you have a responsibility to do your job until such point as some agreement has been made about what your future might hold. You know, this idea that we should give him away for free is laughable, to be honest. Probably similarly laughable is the idea that we should get £10 million for him, because that's not realistic either. You know, he's 34, coming up on 34 years of age, and his Achilles are a problem. I think there's a measure of realism needs to be applied to this situation. You know, you just can't do what he did without it tarnishing your image and without people turning against you. And I think that's happened, and it's completely understandable. But at the other side of it, it's a real shame. Also, I think it's a shame that he felt like this was the only way he could do or achieve what he wanted to achieve this summer, which appears to be leaving the club. There is some talk from people who reckon he might stay. I think Nacho Monreal believes he might well stay still, but to me it feels like a fairly untenable situation. Not least because of the way that Arsenal reacted. They released a statement and made it very clear that Koscielny was the one to blame. I think there's probably a bit more nuance to it. I feel like there's something going on in the background that we don't really know. That's where we are with that. He has behaved. I can't see any way that he stays. He certainly can't remain as captain. And it leaves us in a bind because we already need to bring in some quality at centre half. And I think what this does as well is if Koscielny goes, it means that, you know, maybe a player that we would like to move on this summer becomes even more difficult to move on. And that's, of course, Mustafi. So the consequences, the knock-on effects of this behaviour from Koscielny are really very damaging.
Yeah, I mean, you half wonder if when the club were out there looking at centre-half targets, you know, they identified William Saliba and they realised that was a deal. Well, we'll get on to that deal, but a deal they could only potentially do if they were to bring the player in 12 months' time. And maybe they, at that point, decided, well, we need to keep Koscielny around, and essentially pricing him at £10 million or whatever he's reputed to be charging is a way of sort of taking him out of the market. You know, essentially, we don't want to let him go. The player's clearly not happy with that, but if you put pen to paper on a contract, you know, that's your obligation, that's your responsibility. It works both ways. You know, we can't cancel Mesut Ozil's contract, and nor should Laurent Koscielny just be able to walk out on his. So it's a really unpleasant situation. I know there was some debate over whether the club should have gone public with it. I feel like they probably felt like they had to act in case the other side of the story came out and it looked uglier for them. But yeah, it's a real shame and a real problem, because ultimately I don't think a club who are buying Koscielny are going to think, well, what's happened here is going to make me, you know, pay more money. You're going to think, well, this is great, they've got to get shot of him now, hopefully I'll get him for nothing.
Yeah, exactly. It does, it knocks down the price that we can get for him, and I think we have to be realistic about what a player of his age and physical condition can actually bring in. Do you worry maybe that the club will be okay, well, you're going to sit there, we're not going to sell you, or do you think they will be ultimately forced into doing something, cut price maybe, just to move him on? And because I'm not saying he's a problem player or somebody who's caused us any issues in the past, but right now he is a problem that we have to address.
Yeah, I mean, there was some suggestion that someone might try and buy out the value of his contract, essentially, which is about £4.5 million. So if someone offered that maybe he could go. I mean, I find some sort of compromise like that plausible, but still quite a lot of money to pay for a player of that age who, you know, there's no real guarantee they'll be fit. I'm always a bit, when players say they want to go and then people say, well, they'll just rot in the reserves, it very rarely happens like that. You know, people still reference Winston Bogard as an example, which I think shows you that there is not too many sort of modern equivalents. You know, people are either sold or they are sort of brought back into the first team fold, you know, albeit maybe in a slightly reduced role. So I'm not especially worried about that. It's more just, it's just the centre of our defence. You know, I was someone who at the end of last season said, let's keep Koscielny. You know, let's get as much out of him as we can. He's even if he could only play one in three games, he's still the best we've got. And to lose him leaves us with a big hole there, and we need to bring somebody in. And that's proving increasingly difficult to do as the summer wears on.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the Saliba thing, for example.
What's the latest on that?
The latest on that is that, so Spurs waited for their moment, didn't they, of course? And as soon as all the Arsenal executives flew out to America, they matched or made a better bid than Arsenal, essentially offering €30 million without clauses. So, you know, it was to be paid in instalments, but it wasn't appearances dependent or anything like it. It was essentially a guaranteed €30 million. The stories out of France are now that Arsenal have subsequently agreed to up their offer to match what Spurs are offering. But, you know, it's in the balance, that. I mean, Saliba's, you know what, he's not an Arsenal fan, is he? He's not born and raised in London. And Spurs have Champions League football and Arsenal don't now. So, you know, that really could go either way. And I think it would be painful and embarrassing, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't that just sort of sum up the situation in that? Like, 3 or 4 weeks ago, nobody had heard of William Saliba, really, unless you're a follower of Liga. And perhaps the idea that we would get very angry and upset about not signing an 18-year-old centre-half from Saint-Étienne for quite a substantial amount of money so we could loan him back to that club for a year and not even bring him in to address the central defensive issues that we have at this moment in time. Doesn't that feed into the, going back to the statement in a way, because I guess we can see some logic in it, in that, you know, next year we get a potentially a very good player or somebody that they've identified as a very good player, but a failure to get that over the line sort of talks about how things need to improve at that level of the club, because we have, you know, the Tierney thing going on as well. You know, having gone back in with a bid that
rejected
was rejected as well. I heard from somebody that Tierney is not necessarily that excited about coming to Arsenal. So that might be a factor too. And again, here's a left back who is at the moment not even fit to play. You know, he's going through some rehab following a bit of a surgery or something like that, isn't it? So, you know, again, our transfer business, we're targeting a player who, if we buy him, may not even be available for the start of the season. You know, it's long-term planning, of course. If you identify him as your long-term left back, that's fine. But it just, it just all feeds into this feeling that we're kind of stumbling around in the dark when it comes to our transfer business.
Yeah, and bidding for a player in Wilfried Zaha that we almost certainly can't afford. There are some strange things about our transfer activity this summer. I have to say that, you know, while I think it's fair and I think it's good that the statement criticises Arsenal's transfer strategy in the last few years, I think in Saliba and Tierney, there is a kind of logic there. You know, I was never particularly perturbed by the idea that Saliba wouldn't be available immediately because ultimately he is 18 years old. I mean, yeah. What Premier League team has an 18-year-old centre-half? We're worried about not having him next season. He'll still be 19 then. It's still incredibly young. I mean, I think if you buy Saliba, you're really thinking about him as someone who's going to be in the team in maybe 3 to 4 years or 5 years. When he gets into his early 20s, that's when you expect to see him really at the level that he might possibly reach. So that's such a long-term deal to my mind. I mean, it would be disappointing if it doesn't happen, but we need a team that can compete next season, because if there was anything to be derived from reading those financial reports that Swiss Ramble analysed so brilliantly, it was that Champions League football is absolutely paramount, really. And I do love the idea of having a long-term plan, and I think, you know, we can do both, but we also need to attend to the short-term. And short-term is, I mean, really the pertinent phrase, because we are getting into that last month now of the transfer window, and we need some of this stuff to start happening.
Yeah, they must be talking about it here. They must be, like, discussing what it is that we're going to do in the transfer market. I think it was quite funny last night that the stories about Leicester agreeing a deal for Lewis Dunk from Brighton for £45 million pounds.
And our entire transfer budget.
Yeah, exactly. And while I think we can all understand why the budget is so low, because of the way that the finances have been analysed by Swiss Ramble, and the Arsenal supporters trusted a very forensic look at our finances too. There's a big loss coming down the line. We've spent money badly. We've got wage bill issues and all that kind of stuff. But it does feel a little, when you see Leicester having already bought Tielemans, is it, for £40 million? They're going out and spending £45 million on a centre half from Brighton, and you're thinking, hang on, what the fuck? What's going on here?
Well, I mean, in defence of Leicester, they are expecting a pretty hefty windfall for Harry Maguire. You know, if he goes to one of the Manchester clubs, they're talking about £80 million for that, which would effectively cover those signings. But I think what that shows is that increasingly value is so difficult to define, particularly when it comes to deals between the English clubs. It just feels like every deal is kind of dependent on the fee you get for the player you're selling. You know, there's no relationship. There's no sense of, well, he's a £10 million player and he's a £50 million player. It's just the will of the buying club, how stubborn the selling club are prepared to be, and how rich they know you are. I think what for the fees like the Maguire fee, like the Dunk fee, like the Zaha fee really show, is that Arsenal probably need to be doing their shopping on the continent or in South America. They need to be operating in areas where other big clubs aren't, because we just don't have the financial muscle to compete. And, you know, it's interesting. I think it's in a way good that Edu, Sanyehi, you know, Husfami, all the big guns are out in America.
Husfami is actually back at base in London, Colney. Apparently he's the only one in London at this moment in time.
Right. Well, yeah, what I was going to get on to say is that as much as it's sort of good, I guess, for them to be out there with the owners, you do worry, you know, if they're out there too long, do we need more people on the ground, as it were, you know, dealing with the nitty-gritty of the transfer business? I mean, maybe Husfami's up to the job, but he's essentially inherited Dick Law's role, from what I understand. But, yeah, I mean, there's a... Yeah, it's really concerning. I mean, I think I said on the last podcast we can all start freaking out. Was it about a week today? But I might be moving that earlier soon.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't remember. I mean, what else is happening out there? I see some talk about Dani Alves potentially, which feels quite speculative. And there's the Everton guy, the guy who's actually called Everton. We're not going to buy Everton Football Club.
Yes, although Tim Stillman has been slightly poo-pooing those rumours, saying that a lot of the reports in the Brazilian media are essentially reprints of stories that originated in the English tabloids. So I'm not too encouraged by those. We've talked about the Tierney having another bid rejected. We've talked about Saliba. No talk at all about Wilfred Zaha, who is out of the African Cup of Nations now, and that has gone very, very quiet. I sort of think that deal probably is dead. I just can't really see any way that that's feasible for us, can you?
No, I think if you're Crystal Palace and we've genuinely offered them whatever smidgen of money we can rustle up along with your pick of X player or Y player, or, you know, I don't know why you wouldn't. If you're Crystal Palace and you're looking at the market and Lewis Dunk is fetching £45 million and Arsenal are bidding £40 million for Zaha, why on earth would you consider doing a deal at that price? I think we know what Palace want for him. If they are going to sell him, we must be aware that they've got a price point at which they will deal. And, you know, unless we reach that, I guess we're just going to be wasting their time. So I don't see any way that Zaha gets across the line at all.
Malcolm is one that people are potentially talking about. I mean, that feels plausible to me, in part because we know Arsenal were interested in him when he was playing in France with the Bordeaux. And we also know that Raul Sinyei is a contact-orientated director of football. And where's he got contacts? Barcelona. So I wouldn't be too surprised if they worked out some sort of loan deal or something like that. That feels like it could kind of suit all parties. So that, I think, is one to sort of keep an eye on. I give that a certain degree of credibility. But yeah, it is kind of mad. I mean, I saw this was actually a question that came in from Daniel Ferreira, who's at Dan Ferret on Twitter. But he said, Monchi has already spent 120 million euros this summer with Sevilla. Do you think he realised Arsenal are poor and thought, no thanks? And I think there might be some merit in that, really.
Yeah, quite possibly. Quite possibly. I mean, it would be one of the first questions that you ask, isn't it, as a director or as a head of recruitment. How much money do I have to spend? And what exactly do you want me to do with that money? So if the question posed by Monchi was that, and the answer was, well, we need you to fix the centre of our defence. We need a left back. We also need to replace Aaron Ramsey in midfield. And we need maybe a wide player and possibly a right back too. Here's £45 million, go do your magic. You can understand why he might have gone, no, that's that's too difficult for me. You know, he didn't have a great time at Roma, in fairness, in the way that he spent money. So it remains to be seen what kind of success that 120 million euros brings to Sevilla. But yeah, if you're that kind of guy doing that kind of job, a key consideration has to be the budget. And I guess he wasn't reassured fully by what he would have to spend at Arsenal. So
yeah, and you know, it is kind of galling as an Arsenal fan to see what other clubs are spending. I mean, we mentioned Leicester, West Ham seem to be throwing money around in this window, Tottenham obviously, and you do kind of think, you know, how have we ended up here? And I know those financial results kind of illustrate how it's poor commercial deals, it's dropping out of the Champions League, but it is still a bit of a, it is still quite shocking to think that we have got a transfer budget that in the current market cannot afford Lewis Dunk.
Yeah, there you go. We can't afford Lewis Dunk.
I mean, it's not great, is it? The only thing I sort of, the only positive I can kind of take from it is that, you know, maybe it does mean we're going to go in this youth direction. And I think maybe that's something I could get excited about. You know, I don't want to speak for everybody, but I feel like your enjoyment of supporting a club is kind of in part sort of down to the story that the club is telling you, or the story you're telling yourself about the club. And I think there have been periods in our history where that story has been clear. And you know, even when we moved to the Emirates Stadium, that idea of Project Youth, there was a narrative that we could buy into and believe in. And maybe there's quite a sort of romantic idea about, you know, getting these young players in the team. Whether the reality will match up to that, or whether we'll just be massively exposed, I don't know. But from a sort of romantic point of view, I can get a bit excited about that.
Yeah. I mean, it maybe feels like the only thing we've got at this moment in time.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe that's why. It's necessity, isn't it?
Yeah, it's necessity is the mother of invention, as they say. So who knows what kind of a team we'll put together. All right, will we take a little break here and come back and do questions in part two?
Yes, let's do that.
All right, we'll be right back.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer the questions that you sent to us on Twitter at Gunnerblog and at Arsblog. Also on the Arsblog Patreon Discord server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. And if you want to keep up with the US tour and some of my updates on there, you can join at patreon.com/Arsblog. I haven't done Facebook today because I forgot and I'm far away and weirded out by time zone. So apologies to Facebook. Booker is there, but we will get on that for the next one. So, do you want to start, or will I start, or
I'll start with this one. This is a question actually about the Khashoggi situation from our Discord channel from Singapore Guna. They say, it seems like the club's taken a strong stance here. I don't think the club in the Wenger era would have done such a thing. The thing is, what the club's doing now under Rao's stewardship by publicly throwing Khashoggi under the bus seems to contradict the traditional values of the club that Wenger so often spoke about. Yet, I can't help but think this hardline stance is something that we could have used in the past, and it might not be all that bad. Where do you stand on this? No more Mr. Nice Club, I guess.
No more Mr. Nice Club. It depends what kind of a hand you're holding, though, when you take these stances, right? So, could it be counterproductive? Could it make it more difficult to move Khashoggi on? Could it make it more difficult to get what we actually want for Khashoggi? Potentially. It might also be a case that other players will see the club taking a hardline stance on something like this and think about their own behavior or potential behavior. You know, I don't know. It's very hard to know how this one is all going to come out in the wash. I do think it is possibly counterproductive to have made it so public and to sort of wash our dirty laundry in public the way that we did. It sounded like a statement from people who were quite irate and unhappy, didn't it? You know, it was very, very brief. It was very succinct. It didn't pull any punches in terms of who was to blame for it. And maybe it was a case they were just trying to get out ahead of the story and to stop any speculation. But also, you know, they probably could have put out something else. I don't know why we should do Khashoggi any favors either at the same time. You know, I've liked him a lot as a player, but if it was any other player, they'd be rightly and roundly pilloried for the way that they've behaved. So if we deem the way that he has acted unacceptable and unprofessional, and I think most people do, then I don't suppose there's too much wrong with the Arsenal statement. I wonder, though, do we have to consider why it is that he's felt he's got to behave like this? That's the thing, and that worries me in the background. That is it just another thing that is a consequence of the way the club is being run?
Something I felt about it, and actually it was later confirmed to me when I heard David Ornstein on the Askcast last week, is that as soon as I saw this news, it really struck me that I felt that this was connected to our failure to get into the Champions League. I just think, had we made it, A, we might have been able to give Koscielny an extra year just financially. We might have had the flexibility to do that. Whether that had been wise or not, I'm not sure. But B, I think he probably would have been up for playing in it. I think that there would be more appeal to Dominic Koscielny to play a season in the Champions League than juggling Europa League games around his schedule. And it was just one of the things that made me think, God, it's just so huge that we didn't do it this season. I don't want to continually look back, but it increasingly feels like a real sliding doors thing. If you look at what's happened subsequently in terms of, you know, not being able to afford Zaha, you know, haggling over the Tierney fee, I just feel like a lot of these things would have been alleviated by making the top four or winning that Europa League final. And it's very frustrating looking at it now and feeling like we didn't.
Yeah.
And that's not to absolve Koscielny at all. On the sort of hard line stance from the club, I do like that. Like, I do think we need to behave like that more as a club. And sometimes those values that we had, you know, didn't always help us. I mean, I would only flag that, you know, Raul said in an interview, if someone gets to within 2 years of the end of their contract, we'll have to make a decision on them. They will sign or they will be sold. And what's kind of disturbing about that is when you look at the players we've got, who've got 2 years remaining on their contract, Mesut Ozil, Henrikh Mkhitaryan, Shkodra Mustafi, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, Sokratis, none of these guys currently are extending or being sold.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's to do with their age profile as well a bit, though, for a few of them. But yeah,
I'm not saying it's an easy job, you know, to sell those players. But, you know, there was talk at the end of last season, wasn't there, about Lacazette and Aubameyang potentially signing contract extensions. That's not yet come to pass. For all the talk of having this hardline stance and dealing with things better in future, we've not been able to enact that yet.
That's a fair point. And the hardline stance we have taken is on a nearly 34-year-old player. Okay. Well, I guess we're just going to have to see where this one goes. I sometimes feel as well that you look at, for example, the statement that Atletico Madrid put out about Antoine Griezmann. It was really strong, wasn't it? Very critical of him. But ultimately, Griezmann got what he wanted, which was a move to Barcelona. So regardless of what Atletico Madrid said, they weren't masters of that situation. Or maybe it was just a case of them getting what they wanted. But I think they were always going to get what they wanted in terms of money, simply because he'd signed a new contract. There was a buyout clause in it. As soon as Barcelona met the buyout clause, they let him go, as they had to. But, you know, I don't know. It just doesn't really. The whole situation, I feel, is quite worrying because of A, this is, you know, you're going off on your preseason tour. Everyone knows that the squad needs to be improved. Your captain throws his toys out of the pram. It reflects badly on the captain. It reflects badly on the club. It reflects badly on the way that the people running the club are behaving and operating, simply because, you know, they were not masters of this situation. You know, if things were rosier at Arsenal, I don't believe Koscielny would have done what he did. And that goes back to the end of last season, to the fact that we didn't achieve Champions League qualification, either via the Premier League, which for me is the far more disappointing one, or the Europa League final. That's a one-off game. Shit can happen. Shit did happen. It was particularly shit. So, you know, I think you're right to say it had a consequence of not getting back into the top four last season.
Well, the good news for Laurent Koscielny, I don't know if you've seen this, but Mathieu Flamini has come out in support of him on Instagram.
Oh my God, I saw this. We had a question from it, question about it. Let me just see if I can find the name of the guy here. From Cormac, at Core Maximus. And he says, have you seen Flamini's Instagram post regarding Koscielny? Seems a very odd thing to send publicly versus reaching out privately. And it is, isn't it?
Yes, Lolo, my thoughts and support are with you. First and foremost, I know how committed and true to the Arsenal badge you've been all these years. Furthermore, I know how hard it must be for you to face this difficult situation. Emotions run high, so sometimes with reflection, one can look at things from a different perspective. Given all the above, I'm sure a positive solution will be found. I mean, why doesn't Flamini just send him the 10 million quid, you know?
I don't know. That is so weird. But then, you know, I think footballers are quite weird as well. Yeah, I don't know what to make of that Flamini situation. Maybe he'll come in and sort everything out for
us. Put up the money, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. He can convince Mesut Ozil to do a few things as well if he really wants. Okay, I have a question here. Just bear with me because I clicked off it. It comes from... Redmond, who's that cheesehead gooner, and it goes back to the statement, and he says, is hashtag we care do you about re-engaging the fan base success or prompting action from Stan? The Rams move from St. Louis to LA taught us that you can hit a Kroenke in the wallet, but you can't hit him in the heart. And then we also have a question, let me see about it here. I think it's from God almighty, I'm just all over the place. I apologize. From Richard, who's at r_Gooner, and he said, you both signed the letter that's been circulating today. Do you think it will do any good? We know the answer, he says. But more importantly, does it make our fan base look spoiled? Because all I'm getting from Spurs fans is saying, now you know how we felt forever.
That's an interesting point. I mean, I did have a Spurs fan mate of mine, Adam, text me and say... that he thought it was a good statement, but he felt to an extent it could apply to almost any fan in modern football. And I think there's an element of truth in that, but I don't think that makes it something not worth shouting about. I think that sort of degree of alienation is creeping in all over the place. You know, if you look at Manchester United fans, for example, they're absolutely... furious with their ownership, and I think a lot of other clubs also feel that sense of detachment. But I think this is a pretty extreme case in terms of the Kroenkes, and I think that it does go beyond results on the football pitch. You know, I think there are probably certain Arsenal fans who would be pacified by a big signing or a trophy, but I do have to stress that I think this is about much more than that. I think it is about the direction of the club, the connection we feel to it, you know, the story that we're telling, that we're part of. And I think it's something with a sort of a bigger goal there. So do I worry that it makes Arsenal fans sound spoiled? Sometimes, you know, I had a conversation with a Wolves fan the other day, and they were like, I don't know what Arsenal fans are complaining about. You know, every other fan in a lower league would love to be in their position, but it's all relative.
That's such a weird argument. I get it, but like, you know, the Wolves fan doesn't have to watch Arsenal week in, week out and despair over some of the problems that we've had for a long time that don't ever seem to be addressed. Of course, if you're a fan of, you know, Colchester, you look at Arsenal and think, what have they got to complain about? But it's all relative and it's all comparative to, you know, the standards that we have come to expect from the football club, which I think are we're not meeting those standards, you know. And again, I come back to the point that, you know, the Kroenkes, when they took over, when they bought out Ali Sharuzmanov's shares, and when they forcibly purchased all the shares that belonged to Arsenal fans, who for many had no financial interest in those shares. They weren't an investment in money. They were an investment of commitment and of heart, because they feel connected to this football club they've supported for years. You know, some of those shares were generational, passed down from generation to generation. Stan Kroenke and KSE hoovered up those shares because they were allowed to do so because of the takeover rules. But they said that they wanted the football club to achieve big things, to win the biggest prizes regularly. That's what they said. They said their ambition is to win the Champions League and to win the Premier League. So all the statement is doing, as far as I can see, is trying to hold them to some measure of account to the things that they have actually said. It's not like we are just plucking things out of the air to say, well, we want this and we want that. We want the Emirates Stadium to be a spaceship or something ludicrous. We just want them to do what they said they were going to do. And I don't think that's unfair to hold people to account to the things that they say. In fact, there's far too much in the world right now where people say things and they don't mean them, and nobody is willing or able or capable of holding them to account. You know, again, it might be water off a duck's back, but I think, you know, if people feel strongly enough, and it's clear that quite a lot of people feel very strongly about this situation with KSE and with Cronkies and We Care, Do You? You know, they care. All that they're looking for is a measure of accountability, a bit of transparency, but also, you know, this is a football club which needs to have sporting ambition, and the people who are running it need to act in a way which illustrates that they're serious about achieving the things that they say they want to achieve.
Absolutely. I think that's really well put. And I also think that this, you know, what this will hopefully do is open up a dialogue in a situation where almost no dialogue exists. And obviously with the removal of the AGM, no dialogue is required to exist between ownership and fans. And I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see where that goes. I really do look upon this as the start of something. And referring back to the question, I do think connecting the fan base is a big part of that. You know, for one reason or another, due to a lot of the infighting that's gone on among the Arsenal fans, a lot of blogs, fan groups, influencers, whatever word you want to use, there's been damage done to those voices, and it's been quite a fractured voice. And I do think that this banner that people are assembling under enables Arsenal fans to present a united front on an issue that I think the vast majority of us feel the same about. And I think that makes our voice collectively much stronger. And I think that is a really positive step.
Yeah, it is. It is. And look, you know, what happens at other football clubs shouldn't be used as a measure to judge what's happening at Arsenal. Of course, you know, I say that having said, you know, Leicester are buying Lewis Dunk. But, you know, just generally speaking, what other football fans think of what's happening at Arsenal is not really relevant, because they don't have to experience Arsenal. Every club has its own problems, of course they do, but you know, this isn't an off the cuff, this isn't a spur of the moment type thing. This is something that has been festering for quite some time. For it to come to a point where a statement like that is released and to get the coverage that it has, you know, it's been a while coming, you know, based on the way that the Cronkies and KSE have been running the football club. So if it affects any kind of positive change, then amazing. That would be great. You know, like you, and I'm sure many people listening to this, I'm not necessarily convinced, but I think it's very important that we talk about it and we address it. And so far that's been done. So,
yeah. And also I think, you know, we readily accuse the owner of not being engaged enough, and of course he has a real responsibility to be, but I think as fans we need to be engaged ourselves, and we need to take action where we can and make our voices heard. And it's great that that's happening. Like I say, I think it's a really positive step, and I don't expect it to be an antidote or to, you know, lance the boil or solve the problem. I don't think it's going to be that panacea, but I think it's a movement in the right direction.
Yeah.
And you know, it's very easy to be cynical about that, and I'm sure certain people will be cynical about it, but I think, you know, when you care about something, there's not really room for that cynicism. So yeah, I think it's good.
Okay.
What about this question from Amol, who's at Vella Wolf on Twitter? And Amol says, if we are destined to be stuck with Ozil and Mkhitaryan this season, what do you think should be their ideal target, goals and assists wise? Would 15 goals and 15 assists between them justify their presence and wages?
It would depend on who those goals and assists were against. Like if they're the group stages of the Europa League, then no.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. Given what we're paying them, I think they probably would need something more like that individually, wouldn't they, to justify that kind of money?
Like, I think if you're talking about Ozil, for example, based on what he did last season, which was a huge underperformance in terms of what we know he's capable of, I think, you know, we would look for something like the season he had maybe a couple of years ago where he almost matched the Premier League assist record held by Thierry Henry, no less. Mm. You know, something like that would be the kind of contribution that could have a really, really positive impact on the team, you know? Whether he's capable of doing that anymore, I don't know. Mkhitaryan, I just don't know what you're going to get from him because, you know, one game he can be quite good and then for about four games he's pretty average and then he might be really bad and then he might have a good game or two and, you know, there's an inconsistency there. It really depends on how often they play and in what position they're going to play as well. This is why I'm quite interested to see what we do in these preseason games and what way Unai Emery sets up his team, because you have to imagine that as much as these fixtures are about fitness and conditioning and getting yourself physically ready for the new season, there has to be also a tactical element to it, no? So what way Emery picks his team, whether it's with a back three or whether it's with a back four, might be informative. And from there, we can kind of guess a bit more about how involved both of those players are going to be next season. So, look, I think, you know, for the money that they're being paid, which is basically £1 million every 2 weeks in wages to the two of them, I think there's a measure of responsibility that they produce far, far more than they did last season, which was not good enough by any standards if we're using wages as a measure of what we could or should expect from a footballer. I mean, that is why you pay a guy big wages, is because you're saying you're a very important player. I know it's not the only measure of it, but, you know, people will make assumptions based on the wage bill. I don't think that's unfair. It's always been the case. Same with a transfer fee. If you pay £2 million for a player or you pay £50 million for a player, the expectation is that the £50 million player will be better, more productive, because you're willing to spend that much money on him. It's a show of faith in their talents. So I'm curious to see how they go. It needs to be a lot better than last season, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, you put down money, you want some return on that. And bringing it back actually to the ownership issue and the fans and why comparisons of other clubs isn't that relevant, you have to remember that the fans who turn up at the Emirates Stadium pay more than the vast majority of fans of other football clubs. So that's, it's natural to expect some sort of return on that. Yeah.
Okay, here's a question from the Discord from Giant Cal Gunner, who says, hello, Andrew, great to meet you yesterday. Thanks for a great live podcast. Pleasure to meet you too, sir, as it was to meet all those fans at the event yesterday. But he says, my question has to do with protracted negotiations. Do the odds of a closed deal, a deal that we get done, I guess, drop as the rounds of negotiations go on and the noise coverage in the press and social media pile up? Our best signings of the season seem to happen quickly without a lot of news or social media coverage. Ozil, Sanchez, Mertesacker, Cazorla, Guendouzi, Monreal and more. Should we all start expecting the worst on Tierney and Saliba deals that are just dragging out?
Well, that's an interesting question, because it almost seems to be implying that there's like the way the player performs has a relationship to the way the deal plays out in the media, which I highly doubt. I think it is a concern in the case of someone like Saliba, where there's competition, and I guess with Tierney too, because there's obviously talk of Napoli hovering potentially with a bid for him. I mean, I don't know if they've actually made a formal offer, but the longer those things go on, the greater the risk that you end up gazumped. I think it just doesn't speak to our ability to close these deals particularly well. And I'm not even leveling that as a criticism of Raul or anybody or his family or anyone else involved from a sort of practical point of view. It's more the case that it's a consequence of us not having the money, right? I mean, I think a Champions League club who comes in for Kieran Tierney makes initial offer, gets told, well, it's going to be, you know, 25 million up front or whatever, they just do it. We can't. We just can't do it. So it's sort of difficult, I think, to blame our competence when it seems more to do with cash flow. You know, we have to sort of try and steadily bring the price down because we can't pay what people ask for.
Oh, that makes it very difficult.
Well, yeah, it does. And that's why you end up in situations like the Tierney one or like the Saliba one, where you're sort of hoping it's the will of the player that drives it through, or the Zaha one, I guess, to an extent. But, you know, normally we've been used to operating, you know, even though we had issues with our transfer policy in the past, a little bit like a big club. The big clubs come in and they pay what's necessary. You know, Harry Maguire is not worth £80 million, but he's a necessary signing for Manchester United and they can afford to do it. So they get the deal done. We just aren't in a position to do that. I don't think it's a lack of will, and I can't necessarily speak to a lack of competence. I think the people who are in the job are so new in the job, we can't really evaluate that properly yet. But from a financial perspective, we can't act like a big boy, as it were.
Yeah. Okay.
Cheerful, though, isn't it?
It sure is.
Gunnar Punner asks, if you had to revise your pre-window predictions, how many players do you now think will sign before the start of the season?
I can't remember what I said.
No.
To be honest, I don't know what my prediction was.
How do you feel now, though?
I think we'll sign three players. I think we will. I think we have to. Because we have a question. Yeah. There was a question from somebody about, like, if we didn't sign any players, where do you think this squad would finish next season? And there was a part of me going, well, maybe. And then it was like, nah, about sixth, seventh, maybe. I think with the same squad, maybe we can get more out of them. But I think the idea that we could go into a new season without signing any new players, you know, apart from Gabriel Martinelli, who could be fantastic, but of course is 18 and has got a lot to learn still in his career, it would be just absurd. So I think we have to. I think we have to get some deals done. So I would say three players, but I don't know how that tallies with my previous prediction of how many we were going to buy.
Yeah, I think we'll definitely do two, and I hope we do three. I just think we have to. I mean, in terms of where this squad will finish, the only sort of caveat I would offer is that as bad as we are and as many problems as we have, you know, Chelsea and Manchester United also have problems. And I kind of think that even if we just sort of, I think I maybe heard Tim Steelman say this, but even if we just kind of repeat what we did last year, we might be in the mix still for top four.
Yeah, but you know, you're asking us to repeat what we did last year without probably our captain, without Danny Welbeck, without Aaron Ramsey, without Hector Bellerin and Rob Holding at the start of the season. And their absences were, I think, a key factor in why we didn't finish in the top four, those three long-term injured players. So, you know, it's asking a lot for us to repeat what we did with less than we had back then, unless some of these young players that we have high hopes for can come through and really make a big splash. But, you know, isn't it, as much as we all would like that to happen, doesn't it put an awful lot of pressure on them, those kids?
Of course.
You know.
And just as I urge some realism and caution with Saliba, you know, the same should apply to our academy players. And the other thing to add on top of everything you just said then, of why it's asking a lot to repeat last season, is that we overperformed a lot of our underlying metrics, and you know, there might be a case of that kind of leveling out next season. So
yikes
indeed. Is it your question?
No, it's your question, I think. Is it?
Yeah.
No, you asked the question. It was from
I think I asked the question.
You asked the question from Gunnar Punner. Okay, this one comes from Joachim Runderheim, who's at Runderheim on Twitter, and he says, "You are to set one prediction, preferably a bold one, for one or more of our players. For example, Chambers plays his way into the starting 11, etc. What would be your prediction?"
Oh, that's quite a fun game. My prediction is... I don't think Chambers is going to play his way into the starting 11. And no, to be honest, I'm not...
That can't be your prediction. You can't just unpredict his prediction.
No, that's not what I meant. I was just speculating about that anyway. What is my prediction? I'm having a look at the squad now, thinking... Because I want it to be positive, Andrew. Do you know what I mean?
No, I know. Me too.
I think my prediction is I'm going to predict that Eddie Nketiah will score 10 goals across all competitions.
Wow. I don't even think Eddie Nketiah would be with us.
Yeah. I mean, you might be right.
I have a feeling he'll go out on loan.
Yeah, it's possible.
Okay, that is certainly a bold prediction.
10 goals?
Yeah, from Eddie Nketiah in all competitions. Yeah,
I'm going to go for that.
Okay, my prediction is slightly less bold, but I'm going to predict that Joe Willock will score 5 goals in the Premier League and will be a regular-ish player. Our top scorer, yeah. And will be a regular-ish player in the first team by the end of the season. That's my bold prediction.
Like a sort of Alex Iwobi, sometimes in the team, sometimes not, bit of a rotation option, like that kind of level.
Yeah. Something like that.
I think that's bold enough, to be honest, for a player of that age.
It's not a bad prediction.
10 goals for Andy Nketiah.
That's mental.
Well, hang on. Did I say they'd be for Arsenal if he goes on loan somewhere?
It is evening over there. It's possible that you've had a cocktail or two at this point.
Takuma Asano will score 30 goals.
My goodness. Have we done anything? We haven't managed to sell him yet, I see.
No, he's still there.
He's not on the tour.
He's not on the tour.
Where is he? Where is Takuma Asano?
It's Takuma Asano. Here's a question from Liam Kent, Liam K Football. And Liam says, just how much of a sacrificial lamb do you think Emery is? It feels like he's the man to see us through this 2-year period while we get ourselves sorted at boardroom level. Oh, I feel like I'm crying.
You do? What's going on there?
Well, everyone knows I'm a bit of an Unai Emery sympathiser. Maybe it's just the emotion of the situation.
You've got Unai empathy.
No, and he says, it feels like he's the man to see us through this 2-year period while we get ourselves sorted at boardroom level, while hopefully rebalancing the squad somewhat in terms of quality and wages. Do you think Unai Emery has essentially been handed a bit of a thankless task and is sort of just being left to do that job until we get the new man?
I don't necessarily think he's a sacrificial lamb. I think the reason that they appointed him was because A, he was available, and I think B, they looked at the Europa League and his success in the Europa League as another potential avenue back into the Champions League. Do I feel like he's been handed a bit of a thankless task? Yes, at this moment in time. I won't pretend that I'm a huge fan of Unai Emery as a football coach. I think he seems to be a very decent, hardworking man who's very professional.
Good teeth.
Yeah, good teeth now. He also is a man who was not supported last season by the club at a difficult time. You know, I'm thinking of the January transfer window. I don't want to go over that again, but I think when you lose 3 first team players and you don't get anybody in who can give you anything whatsoever, I feel for him in that sense. Does it excuse the way that the season ended? I don't know that it excuses it. It might explain it a little bit, but I do feel even with the players that he had, he should have got more from games against you know, the Crystal Palace game at home, the Brighton game at home, those two annoying defeats to Wolves and Leicester, you know, that period towards the end of the season, there's no real excusing that, and I think he should have been able to get more out of the team in those games. But at the same time, I don't think he was properly supported. And this summer, I know I said this before, maybe on the last podcast or on the podcast on Friday, I forget because my brain is all over the place being over here. But like, what the fuck must he be thinking? Because the targets for him have got to be the same. People said like the goal was to get back into the Champions League within two seasons. He didn't do it in his first season, and now he's being asked to do it in a second season with a weaker squad, and again no support whatsoever from the football club financially to bring in new players. His captains, you know, decided fuck this, I'm out of here. So it feels a bit like a poison chalice. I don't think it's a case that Arsenal have just said we'll give the job to this guy and, you know, and hang him out to dry. I just think that the circumstances in which he is trying to achieve the things that people want him to achieve are very, very difficult. And I think we have to acknowledge that. I keep saying this every podcast, you know, maybe we'll feel a bit different in a week's time when we sign a player, and a week goes by and we don't sign any players. You know, if I was Unai Emery, I would be, unless absolutely assured of transfer business coming in, I'd be starting to put the pressure on the club publicly to do deals. And that's why I'm curious to see what he says in his press conferences tomorrow and after the game against Bayern Munich on Wednesday.
Yeah, I hope he does, really, for the club's benefit. I agree, you don't hire someone thinking this guy's a sacrificial lamb. You hire them because you think they're going to do a good job. But I would say now the situation that we're in, it does feel more like that, because I think, you know, we've learned more things about the club. We've seen the way things have unfolded. And I do have a certain degree of time for the idea that, you know, Unai Emery probably isn't the guy for the long term. But in terms of having someone in the club who can sort of firefight his way through this period, maybe it makes sense for that not to be Freddie Ljungberg, for that not to be Patrick Vieira, for it to be someone who, for whom we don't have that emotional attachment to a certain extent, and who can just kind of oversee what is a very tricky transitional period. Because it does feel like, you know, I mean, we mentioned those older players with 2 years remaining on their deal, the likes of Ozil, Aubameyang, Sokratis, Mkhitaryan. With some of those guys, it does feel like we're almost kind of waiting for those contracts to end before we can really move on as a club.
Yeah, it was put to me by somebody that is actually, they're a bit like, particularly with the Ozil and Mkhitaryan ones, they're a bit like, well, what the fuck can we do about this? And maybe we're just going to have to wait until they leave. And I know we all think, well, surely there's ways we can move them on, but you know, from everything that I've been hearing, there's sort of an acceptance that it's beyond us to do that. Maybe that again plays into this statement to get better executives or people more capable of doing deals which work in our favor. You know, but yeah,
well, what you have to think is, let's say you're a club with the money to pay them. Would you, looking at last season, choose to?
Yeah.
And the answer is probably no. So, you know, it's not a wonder that it's difficult to move them on. And, yeah, I kind of feel like, to a certain extent, I mean, I know that's only two players we're talking about there, but it's an awful lot of money. And it does feel like our spending is kind of restricted by that for the next couple of years, and that's the led to Mustafi's deal as well, and he's not on nothing. So
yeah, you know, even with this Koscielny situation, which makes it more likely that Mustafi should stay, you know, you think about it, he's got 2 years left on his deal. I know he's kind of damaged goods, and it's a very difficult job to sell him, but if you're not going to offer him a new deal, you should be moving heaven and earth to sell him now this summer. You know, take what you can get for him, accept the fact that we've dealt ourselves a difficult hand, and, you know, we have to accept our own culpability in that regard with these deals that we've given to certain players. You know, that's our fault. You know, you think about the Mustafi deal in particular, you know, we were so desperate to get a central defender that summer that we overpaid for him, obviously. And when you overpay for a player, you know, if a guy is commanding a £35 million fee, which at that point put him in, I think, the top five most expensive central defenders of all time, you know, the wage packet that you can demand if you've got a good agent is reflective of that. So this is on us. So it might be a case of we have to cut our losses a little bit and be realistic about what we can get for a player. Because, you know, if Fenerbahce are interested in Mustafi and we ask them for £25 million, they're going to laugh us out of town. And, they're, you know, nobody's going to pay it. But, like, if Mustafi's available for £10 million, I think there will be clubs out there willing to do that deal. And you get £10 million and you don't have Mustafi anymore. You're faced with the task of replacing him also. But, you know, get the things done that need to be done. And it sounds like I'm crying here, but my... it's not just Mustafi making me cry, but it's my... Yeah, a little bit croaky here. So, you know, I just think that there's got to be some measure of ruthlessness in how we do our transfer business. Maybe Edu's the guy to get it sorted, but, you know, be realistic about what you can get for these players and take what you can get for them and move on, start to move on, because, you know, that they, it just feels like if you're watching Arsenal next season and you're watching the same players make the same mistakes, how disheartening is that?
Well, by process of elimination with the five captains, you're going to see a Granit Xhaka captained Arsenal with Skodra Mustafi playing at centre half because Laurent Koscielny's forced his way out of the club. So
yeah,
it's difficult to feel too optimistic.
Yeah.
But pre-season, you know, is a turbulent time. Things can change rapidly. Who knows? Maybe Stan will dip his hand in his pocket. I doubt it very, 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 very much.
We need some
smart management, because that's it. You know, we don't have the money. We don't have an owner willing to put the money in. And I think that's what's interesting, just coming back to the We Care Do You statement, is that it's not even really asking for Stan to put money in. It's just asking for a clearer strategy and better decision making, really, and some accountability to that.
Yeah,
that's not unrealistic. You know, we might not be optimistic about the degree to which he's listening, but it's not asking for pie in the sky. It's not asking for the moon on a stick. It's just asking to be a well-run football club.
There's interesting, I'm just looking here on the AFC Stuff account, and Kia Jarabchian, you know, the agent, who is very well connected to Raul Senyahi and also to Edu as well, has been talking on TalkSport. He says, I feel for the guys that have just come in, Raul Senyahi, Edu and Unai Emery. I feel for them because we finally got incredibly knowledgeable footballing people there. You can take that at face value if you wish. Finally, Arsenal have people who really understand football and are footballing people in the backroom staff. But the question is whether or not the finances will be made available. There is no big secret. They have to reinforce in defence, in midfield and out wide. Arsenal already have a great advantage in that they already have what many clubs are looking for, two world-class strikers in Aubameyang and Lacazette. The problem is that they have to rebuild everyone else as the rest of the team is lacking. So unless the finances are made available, it puts a lot of pressure on the guys that they have hired to be able to deliver what they have been brought in to deliver. And he's talking about that in the wake of the We Care Do You campaign. So this could be one of the agents who could bring in players that could really help us. And that's what his focus would be, to make sure that the deals we do help Arsenal and not line his pockets.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. But, you know, he's got a very close relationship with Edu. And, you know, if it brings us some decent Brazilian players, then sure, I'm all for it. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, one wonders how close he is to someone like Raul. And he appears to be kind of turning the focus on the owner as well. I suspect Raul Senyahi is also seeing the way this summer is unfolding and thinking, Christ, this doesn't look good for me, even if it is my responsibility. You know, I suppose he'd rather the eye be elsewhere. But
yeah,
it's we're sort of locked in a bit of a holding pattern with some of these players. We can't move on, and it's really inhibited our chance of business this summer. Even with like Tierney, for example, you know, if we get him in, really we need to move a left back on, and I've got absolutely no confidence in our capacity to do that. So it's a very curious situation that we're in right now, and yeah, not particularly pleasant. Hence today, really, and hence some of the outpouring we've seen online.
Yeah.
Let's hope there are good things around the corner. Anyway.
Let's hope so. Have you got any more questions?
I don't really. I'm sort of. I think we've sort of covered them in the more general chat, to be honest with you.
I think we have. And I better sort of, given the time of day that it is in that part of the world, people will be chomping at the bit for a podcast. So it's still early morning here, but it's evening over there. And regular Arscast listeners will be waiting anxiously for the podcast. So I think we'll leave it there, and I'll put it together and get it uploaded. Keep an eye on Arsblog News throughout the next few days, because there'll be lots of coverage of the game against Bayern Munich, and also the press conferences in which Unai Emery, I'm sure, will be asked about our transfer business. It will become an ever more pressing issue over the next couple of weeks. And while we're here on the tour, hopefully they can get their heads together and get some deals done. We'll leave it there, I guess. I'll try and put a podcast together for Friday. I'm traveling, though, this week as well, heading down to Charlotte on Thursday. But I'll do my best. I'll keep you updated on that. And don't forget, you can keep an eye on the exclusive tour diary on our Patreon, patreon.com/arsblog. Until then, we'll catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.